have our next panel, please. Then we'll have Jean, Connie, and Kathy.
Well, continuing on our qualitative analysis, we now have a section on case studies and analysis. And again, I believe the questions that we just recently asked are directed towards the importance of a qualitative look on intangible analysis. Qualitative is probably the best way to go, but we had the morning devoted to finding the best quantitative stuff we could use to give us a qualitative look. So you need the whole thing. And that's the theme of today, is the multifaceted approach that it takes to evaluate things that are, in many cases, intangible. So we'll have Jean Powell give us a look at cost-benefit analysis.
I'm actually going to step back one notch and say we're moving a little bit back towards quantitative with benefit-cost analysis. But, there's certainly a lot of common elements with the GEMS and the status reports. And actually, the GEMS and the status reports are a good source of getting started on a benefit-cost analysis. So I think we have the sequence correct in that sense. First of all, I just want to say it's a real treat to be here at NSF, being asked to present benefit cost analysis and really to share our evaluation practices with other agencies. I began working in benefit cost analysis back in grad school, but then joined Rosalie at NIST back in the late 70s, doing the studies myself. And then many years later, the last 5 years I was at ATP, I got to immerse myself in a number of these studies, working with research contractors. And in that period, the excitement was to see ATP projects mature and to see their impacts emerge through the work of these contractors and developing the impacts in their work. I'm going to just give you a very high-level picture of what benefit-cost analysis is, how it's done, and then I'll give you talk just a little bit about the studies ATP has done that are benefit-cost studies. We've done quite a few, and then I'll just wrap up with a summary of some of the advantages and disadvantages from ATP's experience in working these studies. Basically, the ones that I'm presenting have been done by external government contractors. First of all, what is benefit-cost analysis in terms of its use for us is in program evaluation, and particularly program evaluation of R&D? It's an evaluation tool, obviously, but for estimating net impacts of a federal technology development project or group of related projects according to the program mission logic model and consistent with the timeline that's appropriate for something like R&D or technology development. We're going directly down to the end of that logic model, the inputs, the outputs, the patents were earlier in the life of this, of your project. And down towards later in that timeline, it's seeing those impacts really emerge through your technologies, then over the technical barriers, over the business and economic barriers, and really being used in the marketplace. So that's a distinction compared with some of the other tools we've talked about today, particularly the patents. And it's something that is not usually attempted on a total portfolio wide basis like with the effort with the status reports. It's a more in-depth, more expensive kind of process than that. And the end result, having gone through this work, is to compare the benefits of the project with the cost in a quantitative manner. The analysis can be done as a prospective analysis or as a retrospective analysis or a mix of both. I think ATP got started trying to do prospective ones. I'm going to get at some of the issues when one do that. I think probably a mix of both is where we end up, because if you wait for all of the impacts to happen, the trail is going to have gotten very cold. It's going to be a long, long wait, and you're going to have different problems. So somewhere in the middle, but I'm going to try to illuminate a little bit about those issues as I go here. What is it good for? Well, basically, it is a case study. It falls in that category of evaluation tools of a descriptive case study. But it's one that yields quantitative, dollarized economic estimates of impact. It seeks to provide economic estimates of the downstream benefits to the technology users and to society broadly, getting at some of those intangibles, some of which our researchers are really very good at quantifying, as well as the typical private analysis estimates that you would see out there in the private sector when they're giving yield on investment or other benefit cost analysis studies and results. One thing I want to emphasize here is that it's a quantitative foundation for a very good story. I want to emphasize the utility as a storytelling mechanism, but with a quantitative foundation. It's often integrated with a descriptive case study. I think that's really where its great utility is. It's also most suited to long-term evaluation. I was trying to clue in on that with the discussion of think about the whole timeline. Where does this fit in your logic model? It's down towards the end. It's down there at the long term. Theoretically, you can do a prospective analysis and build in probability adjustments, build in a probability distribution around every one of your estimates. On the other hand, we have learned from experience that those probability distributions need to be very broad if you're dealing early in the timeline and that there's technical issues, there's a lot of business and economic issues, that the error bars are so big that how useful your end result's going to be is, you know, it's certainly subject to question and what we found. So that it seems better to save your investment in these kinds of studies till a little bit later when you're well on the road to a substantial realized economic impact. Basically, for that reason, it's most suited to applied R&D or R&D closer to market once the most significant barriers have been reduced. What does it measure? I think the most common and generally useful measures are these net benefits or benefits in excess of cost, benefit to cost ratio, or the benefits per dollar invested, or internal rate of return, basically the yield on investment. And then what investment? Well, we're talking return on investment. And here I want to segue into another issue that's probably the core issue in doing these studies. It depends on whose return is being measured. And here I want to get you to think about two different ways benefit cost studies can and have been done and kind of give you some highlights of each. I'll start with social return analysis. The second one will be public return analysis. And our social return analysis gets at that, even in government funding, often there's cost share. There's private sector investment, there's public sector investment. You may even have more than one public sector investment. And you have, you know, of course, your company. And you have the returns to many players. You have the return to the companies providing cost share, the innovators, as we first referred to them, and you have the return to the taxpayer most broadly through the a lot public good kind of things and versus actual industrial benefits to direct users of the technology-based products. And basically, the social return analysis stems from the work of Ed Mansfield in the mid-1970s. He was really looking at corporate R&D. He was doing case studies, interviewing, just like we do, really very similarly to the way the status reports are done. And his empirical work was coming up with the dramatically higher values for the complete social returns to technology development compared to the private returns to the innovator. And basically what he's doing is validating growth economics. And that then is the foundation for the social rate of return and social return analysis that we're doing in our R&D program evaluation. It has the three components. It has the private return to the project participants on their own investment and cost share. It has the spillover return, that return to others beyond the private participants and the direct technology users, and then the more broad public good kinds of things. And then it has the complete social return, the benefits to all of those parties on all sources of investment. And if you picture, those costs then would have to include all the costs to generate those benefits, including, say, product development costs, all of the costs needed to generate the total return. Now, with that overview of social return analysis, I'm going to go on to public return analysis, which is really where ATP's studies have tended to focus. And the reason being that it enables us to go more directly to what is the return on our agency's dollars that we put in. We're looking at the increased social return enabled by the public investment relative to just that public investment. It's a lot less complicated on the investment cost side. It's not as simple on the return side. But the investment side, we really want to just look at that bundle of dollars, say, ATP put in. But then the challenge is that, okay, can we get and what do we need to do to get a really independent assessment of that additionality effect of that delta that ATP caused to happen. And that's really the key to public return analysis. But if you succeed in doing it, what you've got is the return on your agency's investment. I just want to go back to the additionality issue because really that getting an independent assessment to the difference ATP made is pretty fundamental, and you have to go at it in a lot of different ways to gain confidence that you've gotten there. And certainly we use the survey results, and they've been pretty time-tested, but we also talk to others in the industry. It's in doing these studies. It's not just taking the company's word for it, although that is still very important. There's got to be a strict counterfactual analysis and isolating what the benefits might have existed from alternative projects that are out there or alternative technologies that are out there. So that's certainly a contributing factor. And then there's also, very importantly, what happens after the technology we're looking at gets successful. Is a competitor with an equally strong technology hit the market quickly? Then the customer could be out there buying that person's product. And really, the benefits attributable to ATP have to be truncated at that point. And I'll just give you one example on that. We funded the biggest project ATP ever funded was a joint venture between two Silicon Valley companies, Affymetrics and Molecular Dynamics. Molecular Dynamics, with ATP funded, produced a high-throughput gene sequencer. This sequencer is touted by the whole genomics industry as accelerating the Human Genome Project by 2 to 3 years. And it wasn't that acceleration per se we measured, but it was the fact that you had this high throughput, this extreme number cruncher, data cruncher capability, and the vast savings in machine time and equipment costs and labor time and all of that for that period. But the interesting thing and kind of scary thing in this business is that, yeah, we accelerated that. It was the first thing out there that was being used by all the labs doing human genome work. But a competitor stimulated by our company came out of the woodwork in a year and a half and had an even stronger machine. And so we had to truncate the benefit estimate after a year and a half. And that's the way it is, but the benefits were great for that year and a half. Now, another issue I just want to hit before moving on is sometimes, but for ATP projects, NSF is probably the most common second source. Not necessarily second. Sometimes it came first before ATP, and at least one of the studies we did, it came after ATP. And so, you know, the technology has elements of both. And the benefits were dependent on both sources of funding. And in one of the cases, NSF was twice and ATP was once. So we had to allocate the benefit, and that becomes an issue as to what's appropriate. Typically, we've used allocation by prorated dollar shares, but that isn't necessarily the best thing to do, and it's a judgment call. Okay, briefly, how does it work? Well, we're talking about monetary valuation of benefits and costs expressed as cash flow analysis. And this diagram shows it, I think, a little better than I can say it. Let's just think of a simple public return on investment case. And you have data records at our agency about what the investment costs are. Public return, we're looking at ATP's dollars, and we're looking at the cash flow by year. Say it's a three-year project, and that's the dollar outflows. And then we're starting after a few years, the ATP funding has ended, benefits are starting to kick in, and that becomes the benefit inflows. And we're seeing through investigating with our researchers the technology advantages yielding a quantitative benefit in terms of a technology delta, and we're coming up with estimates of sales volumes that give the other piece. And you typically that's what you're doing. You're putting together a technology delta with a sales volume, and you're using a lot of different sources to estimate that. Not just the company's impressions, particularly if they are still not fully commercialized yet, which is the case in some of these projects. And then you've worked out through the benefit period up through when you think a competitor might take over the marketplace, and you're offsetting those benefits by any losses to the pre-existing technology and the pre-existing technology's owners. The cash flows are then time-adjusted to constant dollars. Typically, the out-year cash flows are just expressed in the values of a dollar at the time the study is done. Then they're adjusted for the opportunity cost of money by discounting. We typically use, we really always use a 7% real rate under the mandate of OMB Circular A94. And then the cash flows then that we have fleshed out and time adjusted, we then adjust for risks and uncertainties using expected value analysis, particularly, which is almost always the case if the out years aren't fully realized benefits yet. Then your metrics are computed typically with Excel. Here's a list, and I think it's on the website, right, Richard? I don't know that you're going to be able to see this of the studies we've done. We've maybe done a few more than that. 14 benefit cost studies spanning 32 ATP projects. Most are microeconomic, cash flow based, but three were expanded to really go through a macroeconomic analysis using REMI, Regional Economic Models, Inc. Two used hedonic price indexes for benefit estimation rather than cash flow analysis, but most were cash flow based. Costs of these studies ranged from $25,000 in the very early kind of exploratory studies, not terribly empirically based, to about $250,000 for the last several studies that we did. And those last several studies covered multiple projects. The number in parentheses is the number of projects covered in the study. In the last four studies, we really, when we're getting into multiple projects, we referred to them as cluster analysis. Basically, we did an in-depth quantitative benefit cost study of two to three ATP projects, and we compared the benefits of two or three with the costs of a broader group of which they were a member, or even a whole ATP-focused program. As a result of this comparison of the benefits of a couple of strong projects to the costs of a larger group, we had a minimum estimate of the benefit-cost relationship for the for a broader sort of portfolio or program or thematic area, however you want to look at it. I'm going to skip over these two slides that are a little more detailed on advantages and disadvantages and try to hit the highlights here in the summary slide. And I'll pick up some of those other points. They're all on the website. This is a practical approach for long-term evaluation of program impacts. It's not inexpensive, but you can gain a lot of ammunition for working with policymakers. You've got stories to tell. You've got quantitative results. Your stakeholders, your policy analysts understand the results. They're in a language that they understand. I'd say the major question we've had from policy owners is, one, they want the benefits to be retrospective, if at all possible. They don't trust highly prospective analysis. That's one. And they wonder why these social rates of return and these public rates of return are as high as they are. They don't quite get it, that whole growth economics concept that that the spillovers are huge relative to what the private sector may be getting as a return. And then I just want to close with the fact that the utility of these studies increases as the empirical basis increases. That goes with what I've been saying. Get over those technical barriers at least before you start doing one. Preferably get through product development. There's a lot of money that goes into, a lot of financing needed to do product development before a technology is broadly commercial. And the whole entrepreneurial talent thing is very important. And then there's the, will the market pick up the new exciting way of doing something, or will it stick with the old way of doing something? And there have been a lot of tragedies where, at least yet, we thought conditions were absolutely there for take-up and huge benefits. But the companies are very, the potential, what do you want to call it, big companies who would have to invest in these technologies haven't taken the plunge to really bring the uses of the technology to fruition. And then there's the whole issue of economic diffusion. We're all funding technology development that could go many directions, had many broad applications, and the companies can't really go more than one or two at a time. And so the time it takes to wait for all of that to happen and whether it will happen, creates a lot of uncertainties, and it leaves us as our challenges to when the best time is to do these studies. I think I should end there. All of these studies are available on the ATP website. Thank you.
Thank you, Jean. Jean told us about one tool, cost-benefit analysis methodology,